You're listening to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. The following program is a rebroadcast of Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Shoman.
Hi, this is Roy Shoman, and welcome once again to Salvation is from the Jews, the show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic faith, or seen the other way around, that celebrates the completion, the fulfillment, the full realization of the promise of Judaism in the Catholic Church and its sacraments. If you've been listening to the show for a while, you know that one of my absolute favorite things to do on the show is to have on another grateful Jewish entrant into the Catholic Church to share with us how grace worked in his or her life to bring him or her also into the Catholic Church, and to see the Catholic Church for what it is, as the continuation and realization of Judaism after the coming of the Jewish Messiah. So today, once again, I have the great honor and privilege and pleasure of having on the show as a guest a friend of mine that I met in Great Britain a number of years ago, probably about 6 or 7 years ago now, who has a most remarkable story to tell about how he too came into the Catholic Church. So with that by way of introduction, are you there, Bernard?
I am indeed.
So
yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and share with us what a nice Jewish boy like you is doing in the Catholic Church?
Right. Well, it's true, a nice Jewish boy, and I think the road from Orthodox Judaism to becoming a Catholic is a very long one, particularly for me, because I was brought up in a very Orthodox Jewish area in North London, a place called Stamford Hill, where we had immigrants from Poland and Russia and some from Germany who were the Hasidim, the people that used to wear long gowns and high hats and always wore a beard. And they were 50% of the people in Stamford Hill, and the other half were non-Jews. And they never understood one another at all. The non-Jews thought that the Jewish Orthodox were living a separate life. They had their own shops, they had their own schools, and they dealt with one another, but they were very, they kept themselves to themselves. And the Jewish...
I'm terribly sorry. We seem to have lost our guest there for a few moments, but I think we have him back now. When we lost Bernard, he was just telling us about growing up in North London area, which consisted about half of Hasidic Jews and half of non-Jews who didn't understand what was going on. And if I could ask you to pick up there again, Bernard?
Certainly. I told you a little bit about the attitude of the non-Jews towards the Orthodox Jews, but the Orthodox Jews would tell me and everybody else that we should stay away, well away from the Christians, who were mainly practicing Catholics, because they were demonic. He'd heard on very good authority that they used to eat flesh, and they used to drink blood, and they prayed to a woman god, and they believed in a ghost. So there you are, there was, you know, the elements of truth, but not really what the real meaning was. And that's how I grew up. With my father, I used to go to the synagogue, and we used to pray three or four times a day, and all day on Shabbos we would be in the synagogue all day. And slowly as I got older, I became disillusioned with the Orthodox faith, and I just drifted further away and further away. And by the time I was 19 or 20, I really had no religion at all. And then I'm going to tell you that the first step to my conversion was a most unusual one. I was in a nightclub in London called the Whiskey and Go-Go, and a beautiful girl came in, and I danced with her, and we became friendly, and she was a cradle Catholic, and she led me into the Catholic faith, because neither of us knew it at that time. She was also disillusioned with the Catholic faith, because she had been brought up in a very austere church where the people there were not particularly friendly to young people. So she had drifted away to the extent of being only a Sunday Catholic, so because of her upbringing, she went to Mass on Sunday, but nothing else in her heart. She didn't really feel anything. We went out for quite some time, and then we both experienced the greatest force that there is, and there is no greater force than that, and that's when people fall in love. And when they're really in love, they'll overcome any sort of difficulties, different religions, different colors, different race. Love is the very powerful force. And so eventually we became married, and within our marriage we've had 5 children, and now we've got 12 grandchildren. So the question was always how we would bring these children up, with what religion they would follow. And we really told them all about the Catholic faith and all about the Jewish faith, which of course is Catholicism is a continuation of Judaism, so it wasn't too hard for them to understand. And then we left it to them to decide what faith they would follow. As it happens, about 3 of the girls are Catholic. One of the boys follows the Jewish faith, and the other one doesn't follow any faith at the moment. But his brothers and sisters are trying to get at him. So that's how we carried on for many years. Sue, during that period, was always trying to convince me Messiah had come and had gone, whereas Orthodox Jews pray daily for the coming of the Messiah. And she felt sorry for them because Jesus had come and been and died on the cross and was resurrected, but the Jewish people hadn't recognized it. And because we both had good religious educations, we used to have long discussions about faith. And I have to say that for every good reason to believe that Christ is our Savior and the true Messiah, there's an equally good reason for us not to believe that. So we carried on, and then one day Sue heard about Medjugorje. She was actually cleaning the church with a woman, traditional Catholic, cleaning alongside, and the other woman said to her, "Have you heard that there are 6 children appearing where the Virgin Mary is appearing to them in Medjugorje?" And Sue said no. She was fascinated because ever since she was a little girl, she'd always had an affection to the Virgin Mary, to the Mother of God, because at the convent she went to, they had told her about Bernadette at Lourdes, and that had fascinated her. So she said to the woman who was next to her, "Please tell me about it." And the woman said, "No, it's not true. It's just made up, and you don't want to have anything to do with it." But Sue persevered, and eventually she found some people who knew about Medjugorje, and they told her all about it, and she was desperate to go there. She said to me, "Let's have a holiday this year. We haven't had a holiday since last year." I said, "Yeah, that's fine. Where do you want to go?" And she said, Yugoslavia, as it was then. And I said, "Why do you want to go there? It's a communist country." And she said, "Oh, I'd love to go there." And I said, "Oh, you don't really want to go on holiday there. You want to go there so you can go to that place where your lady," note that I didn't say our lady, I said your lady, "is appearing." I said to her, "Look, I'm Jewish by birth, and if you really loved me, you wouldn't want me to go to a place where people are laying prostrate on the ground, beating their chests and drinking watery soup." And she said, "Well, if you really loved me, you'd take me there." We didn't go. And then about a year later, she said, "Let's have another holiday." And she said, "Let's go again to Yugoslavia." And I said, "Well, I know why you want to go there. And okay, if you're feeling that it's that important to you, we'll go there. And we'll have a holiday with the children. And maybe for 1 or 2 days, we'll go off to Medjugorje." So that's what we did. When we went there, it was 1982, a year after the apparitions had started. And there were very, very few pilgrims there. But we went, and we were shown round, and eventually we found the parish priest, who at that time was Father Thomas La Pervan, and we asked him if there was anything in English about the happenings there. And he said, "Well, there's only 2 of you. If you can find another 4 people, I'll show it in the basement of the presbytery." So we hurried round and we tried to find some other English-speaking people. And in the end, we only found three, so there were five of us. And I said, we can't get six, we can get five. Is that good enough? And he said, yes. So he showed us a very early video of what was happening there. And then it was getting to about 5 o'clock, and it was time to go back to our hotel in Dubrovnik. So I said, we better go back now, Sue. She said, oh, please, 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 please let me stay for the Mass, and let me be here when the Blessed Mother appears. So because she was so desperately wanting to be at the place where she believed the Mother of God was appearing to these visionaries, we went to the church, and she stood by the side wall. There was a room there on the other side of the altar, which is now a place where the priests robe, and that's where the visionaries used to have the apparition of the Blessed Mother. So we're standing outside with a big crowd, and everybody's begging that they can go into the apparition room. And I remember very clearly that there was a woman there with a very, very sick child. There were tears streaming down her face, and she said to Father Tomislav, please, please, please let me go in. And there were other people who were also begging to go in. And then a woman called Anita Curtis came alongside him and said, you see that man over there, his name is Bernard Ellis, and he's Jewish. You must let him in, because the Blessed Mother will be so pleased to see him here. Which I thought was so ridiculous, because if Mary was coming through time and space, she wouldn't be interrupted by a wall. But nevertheless, Father Tomislav was getting a little bit fed up with all the commotion that was going on outside the church. So he grabbed about 20 of us, including myself and the woman with the very sick child, and he ushered us into the room of the apparitions. And this all took place in August, and it was very, very hot. So we were standing in this room, and there were so many people there, it was just shoulder to shoulder. And eventually the visionaries came in, and we were all playing the rosary. Everyone except me. And they then fell to their knees, and they looked at a statue, a very badly painted statue in that room. It looked like Snow White, actually. It was so badly painted, and they all fell to their knees. Now, I told you we were standing shoulder to shoulder. When we kneel, or when people kneel, they take up twice the space, and so we were all hot bodies pressing against one another, and because there was no room to stand anymore, I had to kneel. As you know, Jewish people don't kneel because they're afraid of being guilty of worshipping a graven image. But I couldn't do anything else but kneel. And so I was in this room, which was very, very hot, and I had a knee from the woman behind me on my calf, and another one who had her knee on my foot, and it was the most uncomfortable situation to be in. And I thought to myself, this is no place for a Jewish boy to be. Anyhow, they continued praying, and eventually the room went into silence, and the Mother of God was appearing to the visionaries, and there was total silence, except for the woman with the sick child, and the child was crying, and so was the mother. And I was looking at these people and thinking, this is really, you know, this is just a joke, it's not true. And I wasn't thinking any holy thoughts. But I did look at the statue, and I did look at the wall behind, but of course I didn't see anything at all. And then, before I knew where I was, everybody stood up, and the visionary read out the message. Well, she said it in Croatian, and then it was quickly translated, and then we were all ushered out of the church to the side entrance where all the crowd was standing. And they looked at us as we came out, and they thought how fortunate we were to have been in the room of the apparition. And I think that in the whole of that area, there were hundreds and hundreds of people. I was the only one that didn't believe it to be true. Anyhow, I'd bought Sue on our anniversary a gold rosary, and it was real gold. It was 18 karat gold, and it had all the beads on it and a cross and medals. It was very beautiful and very, very expensive. And I had noticed that Sue never prayed with it. She just used a wooden or plastic rosary. But on that occasion, she was clutching it. And when Father Tomislav came out, she said to me, "Can I give this to Father Tomislav?" And I thought, gosh, that cost me a lot of money. But being as kind as I could, I said, "It was a present to you, so you must do with it what you will." So she gave it to him, and she went out and bought another plastic rosary, as it happens. So I guess I'm the only man in the world who went to Medjugorje and had a gold rosary turn into a plastic one. So that's the way it happened. And we went home. I had found Medjugorje to be a very peaceful and prayerful place, but I didn't believe what was happening there. And then a year later, Sue said, "Can we go again? And this time we'll leave the children behind and we'll spend a week there." And I didn't mind because Medjugorje was so pleasant and the people were so friendly. And so we went. And on that occasion, another strange thing happened to me. Because I was Jewish, I was known as the Jewish Catholic. And a lot of people get to know me because I'm quite friendly. And I made friends with Maria the Visionary, and she invited me to an apparition. So this apparition took place in her house, and we went there, and there was a crowd of about 100 people. Maria came out at the time when they were reciting the rosary. She fell to her knees, so did everybody else. And the apparition took place, and at the end of the apparition, she told us all what was happening. Again, I didn't believe what was happening. And I then said a prayer to God that if this is true, because I wasn't certain, I want you to give me a sign, a real sign that I can understand so that I know it's true. So she told us about the apparition, and then at the end of the apparition, she said, and then our mother prayed in a language I don't understand. It was her mother tongue. And I thought, golly, that's a sign. And then I thought about it, and I still didn't believe that there were really apparitions happening there. So we went on. We used to go to Medjugorje quite often. For Sue, it was a place of religious renewal, and for me, it was an interesting place just to go and relax. And then a year later, we were going every year. We went there, and we heard an apparition was going to take place on the top of Krusevac Mountain. So Sue wanted to go there, and we knew that there'd be enormous crowds, so we got there very early, and we were sitting at the foot of the cross. And what we often did at special occasions like that, we would talk about the religion, and she would be really pointing me to Isaiah's prophecies and other prophecies, and wondering why I couldn't understand that the Messiah had been. So we talked like this, I telling her about the Jewish perspective and also the many reasons why you can contradict the existence of Christ. And we went on for quite some time, and then it got very dark, and then there was a lantern which was coming up the hill, and there were young people singing. And these young people, the crowd parted, and they came right to the foot of the cross. And at the foot of the cross, they started to pray. And after they'd prayed for about 2 minutes, Maria and the people with her all fell on their knees. And the man standing at the end said to me, "Are you English?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, tell the crowd that the Mother of God is appearing to Maria. They should all be silent. They should pray and not take any photographs." So this Jewish man turned around and said, "Everybody kneel, no photographs, the Mother of God is appearing to Maria." And with that, everyone went on their knees, except me. And I was actually standing shoulder to shoulder with Maria. And because everybody else was kneeling, and I had told them to kneel, I felt really embarrassed at standing up. So I knelt. And it wasn't really a holy experience. I was I was thinking, these stones on the ground are cutting into my knees. It's really uncomfortable. And then my mind wandered on to, I wonder how these Catholics managed to kneel for so long. Maybe God gave them special hardened knees so they were able to do it. And as these thoughts were going on through my head, I felt a drop of water fall on my head. And my thoughts then changed to the fact that it was going to pour with rain, and the mountain was very high and it was slippery, and we'd all have to get down the mountain, and it would be a very dangerous thing to do. And as I was thinking this, the apparition ended, and Maria got up, and people put little recorders right up to her, and there was various translations. Eventually the English translation came out, and the man who spoke English called out to the crowd that the mother had blessed the people there with extended hands. She had prayed particularly for the sick, and she'd recommended all your petitions that you brought with you in your heart. And it was at the time of Assisi, and she said she was, the Mother of God was sad about what was happening in the world. And Maria said she was standing on a cloud, and as she said she was very sad with what was happening in the world, a tear ran down her cheek and onto the cloud. And it didn't rain that evening, and when I told Sue about it, she said, the tear from the Mother of God has fallen on your head. And I thought, well, I did certainly feel some rain coming onto my head, and it didn't rain. So I pondered it, but I didn't believe it was a sign. I still didn't believe. So when we got back to the guest house, there was a priest there. His name was Robert Cox. He came from America. And I told him what had happened to me. And he said, the Lord is calling you to baptism. I didn't even know what baptism was. So soon I dismissed it and thought it was just another coincidence. And it wasn't the sign I was waiting for. And then there was a third experience when I told you about the first one and the second one. Well, actually, there were three experiences when I was forced to kneel. And I told you that from the way I was brought up, Jewish people don't kneel. So it was also a fear of worshipping a graven image. So this next experience was at a place called Walsingham, which is a Catholic shrine where Henry VIII used to go on pilgrimage, there was a slip of chat, but I think you've been there, Roy.
Yes, and it's a shrine to the Blessed Virgin Mary, right, Our Lady of Walsingham.
That's right. Yeah. And so I was there. There was a week's conference. And I think, Roy, you were one of the speakers at the conference at one time. Anyhow, on this particular night, they were celebrating the sacrament of reconciliation, and there was about 3,000 or 4,000 people there, and they were invited to come forward to one of the many priests that were there and to confess one of their worst sins, and then they were given a candle, and then they went from the marquee where the service took place into the darkness, and they were singing and holding their candles. It was symbolic of coming out of the darkness and bringing the light, so coming out of the marquee and bringing the light into the darkness. And as this service of reconciliation was taking place, they wended their way into the Reconciliation Chapel, which is in Walsingham, and they assembled there, a great number of them, because Father Slavko from Medjugorje was going to celebrate Eucharistic Adoration, the time when I leave, because everybody kneels and I don't kneel. And I'd been to Adoration with Sue many times, and I'd never stayed there. So anyhow, Father Slavko came onto the altar, and he was going to place the monstrant there so that the people assembled could pray in front of the monstrant. But he looked down at the crowd, and they were very bubbly and talkative. They were all sort of happy that their sins had been forgiven and they'd been released from their sin. And they were just making so much noise, and they were so active that Father Slavko didn't think they were in any fit state to be able to worship the true presence of God in the monstrance. So he waited for a very long time, and eventually, without saying a word, this assembled crowd got quieter and quieter and quieter until there was silence. It reminded me of my first experience when I went into the apparition room, the first time I ever went to Medjugorje, the silence that was there. And then Father Slavko placed the monstrance on the altar, and as he did so, everybody fell on their knees. Some people fell prostrate on the ground, and there was total silence. And I would normally have left there then, but it was very interesting for me to see how Father Slavko had brought this crowd to silence and how silent they were after having been so noisy. So I decided to stay, and if I stayed and everybody else was kneeling, I knelt again. I think that's the fourth time that I had ever knelt. And as I was kneeling, I looked at the monstrance because I wondered what all the people there were staring at. And then I looked from the monstrance to the eyes of the people. And I kept doing this, following the eyes of the people, worshipping this monstrance and the Holy Eucharist in the monstrance. And I kept staring at both. And then I had a gift from God, which is not explainable. In spite of all the conversations I'd had with my darling wife, Sue, who tried to convince me that God, that the Messiah had been, I knew and felt deep in my heart that there was a presence in that monstrance, in the Eucharist that was there. And I just knew that God was present there. There's no explanation from that. It's just a pure gift from God. So at that moment, I decided to become a Catholic. And I went to my parish priest, a priest called Daryl George, and I told him that I would like to inquire into the Catholic faith. So he told me about the Catholic faith. He told me about the Eucharist and the true presence of God in the Eucharist. He told me about confession, and he said that if you make mistakes, then God will forgive you if you're truly repentant. You can't just go along and say you're sorry. You have to really mean it. And he told me that I hadn't been baptized, so I would need to become baptized before I could become a Catholic. So he also told me that at the point of baptism, all my past sins would be washed away. And I hadn't been a very good boy, and I had many, many sins, so this seemed very attractive to me, that at baptism I would become pure, that if I made a mistake, God would forgive me if I was really sorry, and most of all, that when I received the Eucharist, I would be receiving the body of Christ, who would be coming to nourish and strengthen me in my body and spirit. So that was very good reasons to decide to become a Catholic. And through the instruction, there were many, many things I didn't understand. You had to accept them. I had to accept them in faith and admit that I didn't understand them. But the great advantage of being a Catholic far outweighed what I didn't understand. So I was received into the church on Holy Thursday, which was at that time, they don't always coincide, but in that time it coincided with the Passover, Pesach, so it was Pesach and Holy Thursday, and in our Jewish tradition, as many of you will know, it is believed that the Messiah will come on the first night of Seder. So the Messiah had come on the first night of Seder, when I was received into the church. And apart from that, it was also my birthday.
Wow. Let me just underline that, because, of course, Holy Thursday night was the moment when Judaism turned into the Catholic Church, right? Because the Last Supper was a Passover Seder. One could think of it as the last sacramental Passover Seder and the first Catholic Mass. So you made the transition from being Jewish to being a completed Jew at the very moment, so to speak, that Judaism made the transition from being Judaism to being completed Judaism.
Exactly. And I was very conscious of what a privilege that was, and also that it was on my birthday. So this Jewish man was being reborn on his birthday at the time when it is believed that Jesus came and gave the world,
wow,
you know, his love and his grace and all his beauty. So I was very conscious of that. And as I said, there's many things I didn't understand, but I became a practicing Catholic together with my wife and three of our children. And as I continued in the Catholic faith, the things that I didn't understand, I would always ask the parish priest, because, as you probably all know, Jewish people debate things, and if they don't know something, they're not afraid to ask the questions. So I would always ask the questions and find out the answers. So over the years, I became quite knowledgeable in the Catholic faith. I was very privileged because I'd had a Jewish education and now a Catholic education. I was always a little surprised that the Catholics didn't all know very much about their own faith. They'd been cradled Catholics, they'd been brought up in the faith, they knew many of the traditions of the faith, but they didn't know all the deep meanings. And so I found out all that it was. Nobody ever objected to explaining it to me. And now I've been a Catholic for 20 years, getting very old, go to confession every month, and I think it was a wonderful gift from God, which I truly am happy happened to me. And no explanation, just a pure gift, and no real explanation. So that's my testimony, Roy, and I consider myself to be very privileged. I go to talks like you give, and each time I learn more and more, and I go to other talks, and so I'm becoming quite knowledgeable.
Well, it's a
but thank you, Roy, for listening to my testimony. Have you got any questions you want to ask me?
Well, first of all, I just want to give a little credit where credit is due. I have no idea where the grace for your conversion came from, but I'm sure that the prayers and suffering of your faithful wife over all of those years contributed an awful lot to it.
Yes. Well, my wife, she still is, but she was when she was younger, an extremely beautiful girl. And I was drawn to her great beauty. All the Jewish girls I went out with reminded me of my sister. And we didn't get on too well, so Jewish girls were at a disadvantage so far as I was concerned. But when I saw Sue, she was really beautiful, but not a fully practicing Catholic. She only went to Mass on Sunday morning because she thought that was the right thing to do. And if she missed some Masses on the Sunday morning, for example, one, she would then miss maybe two or three because she knew she had to go to confession, and missing three Masses was the same confession as only missing one. So we traveled along. We went into the world of materialism, which didn't make us very happy. Sue used to go to Mass maybe once every two Sundays and then to confession after, for having missed one Sunday. And then we went to the Holy Land, we went to Israel, and we went round, we'd been before, and we went round to all the places that were the historical Jewish places and the historical Christian places. And on one of our visits to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, Sue knelt at the Stone of Unction, where Christ's body was washed. And she was praying there, and she had an amazing conversion at that moment, an amazing conversion, and she wanted to return deeply into her faith.
Wow.
But her memories from her childhood of the very austere Catholic Church, she lived in a country village called Rustington. And there was a congregation there, mainly elderly people, who never spoke to her. And the priest, when he gave his sermon, he would bang on the pulpit and say, if you don't change, you're all going to hell. And there were these elderly people of 50, 60, 70, even 80, all shaking. And Sue just was very uncomfortable with the sermons and the fact that everybody was so unpleasant. But then at the Stone of Unction, she had this conversion experience, and she came back to England, and she started searching for another faith. So she went to the Evangelical Church, which was very happy and clappy, and everybody was really friendly and very nice. But she couldn't stay there because she couldn't deny Christ and the real presence in the Eucharist. And then she went to charismatic meetings, and she didn't really feel, you know, that this was the place of worship for her. So eventually she came back to the Catholic Church in a very real way, and has become a daily Mass goer.
Oh, that's this beautiful symbolism there too, because at the very place where the body of Christ was kind of purified for his burial, her Catholicism, in some sense, was purified. Her relationship to the Church was purified. You mentioned your experience of Father Slavko, and the role that it played in your journey. I think that you had an experience of Father Yozo that also played a role.
Yes, we went to hear Father Yozo speak in Tehaluna, and there was an enormous crowd there, and an interpreter who in those days was before Nancy interpreted, but it was another girl, a Serbian girl, who had become a Catholic. And as she translated the words of Father Yozo, I realized that he was a very holy man and also a very knowledgeable man. And this was all before I became a Catholic. So at the end of his talk, which went on for two and a half hours, he went outside the church and a big crowd gathered in front of him so that they could speak to him or he could bless them. And I said, I want to go for a special blessing with Father Yozo. And she said, well, you've already had a blessing. You were there in the church, and Father Yozo gave his blessing to all the congregation, so you don't need to be blessed again. I said, no, I want it personal for me. So we queued up, and we were right at the back of the queue, and we queued up for maybe an hour and a half, with Sue getting more and more impatient because she didn't think it was necessary for him to bless me. And all the coaches went, and then eventually all the crowd went, and it was just me and Father Yozo and his interpreter. And I told the interpreter to tell Father Yozo that I'm Jewish and I want God to reveal the truth for me. And so Father Yozo, in a loving way, he put his arm round Sue and his arm round me, and he prayed over us. And I remember that as he prayed over us, my heart started to thump and thump and thump. And it felt like it was bursting out of my shirt. And then he stopped praying and he shook hands with me and Sue. And we went home. And again, this thumping, thumping of the heart, that was another sign. So I'd had about five signs that could be very real ones that could have helped me on my conversion, but I never accepted any of them. And the only time I decided to become a Catholic was a gift from God, which can't be explained.
And of course, the signs were too.
Pardon?
Those signs were also gifts from God, which did propel you on your way.
It propelled me on my way. But you see, the big thing for me is, strange as it may seem, my conversion happened in the Whiskey and Go-Go when I met Sue, because if it hadn't been from her and the journey we traveled together, I might still be a Jewish boy.
Well,
I am a Jewish boy.
That's what I was going to ask you about. Do you feel like you're no longer Jewish? Do you feel like you're more Jewish than ever? How does it feel to you?
Well, I feel that I'm a completed Jew. I'm Jewish. If you're born Jewish, you're Jewish, and you will remain Jewish. But I feel that myself, I'm a Jewish man who has accepted Christ as my Savior and found that Christ was really present in the Catholic Church. So I consider myself Jewish, but I follow the Catholic religion.
And I, if I can say so, logically, that should mean that you're more Jewish because you're a Jew who's a follower of the Jewish Messiah. So you're really just, if I'm allowed to say this, you're just a Jew who's right about what happened to Judaism.
Exactly. And I tell my friends in the church they should respect me because I am a direct descendant of Abraham, and they are only grafted on, so they must give due respect to me.
It reminds me of something that St. Ignatius of Loyola said when he was accused of being Jewish, of having Jewish blood. He said, "It's not true, I don't, but if I did, I could imagine no greater honor than being related by blood to our Savior."
Yes, of course, many people talk about the Jewish people as being God's chosen people. I don't really accept that. I think they were chosen for a purpose, and part of the purpose was that from their roots would come the Messiah. So they were chosen from this purpose. And also Jesus said through his ministry, and particularly at the Last Supper, "This is my body, this is my blood, eat this as a memorial to me." And Jesus, with his Jewish background and being a teacher, a rabbi, he would know that in the Levitical law it says you mustn't eat flesh and drink blood. So he knew this would be an obstacle which would prevent many of the children of Israel, the chosen ones, to follow him. And so there is a purpose that he used these words. And the purpose was obviously that the Jewish people should remain identifiable for whatever God's plan is for the future.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, that's explicit in Romans 11. St. Paul says, yes, God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that should not see and ears that should not hear. Let their eyes be darkened so that they cannot see until the full number of the Gentiles come in, and so all Israel will be saved.
That's exactly right. So I believe that. And I really enjoy going to church. I still have Catholic friends, many Catholic friends, because that's where we worship in a community, and I still have Jewish friends. But I never tried to persuade my Jewish friends to become Christians or Catholics, because I always think that is a gift from God. And from my experience of Sue having spent 30 years trying to persuade me what was right and what was true, it never worked. So it was only the gift from God. And the signs never worked. We say rightly that they were part of the journey that led me on, but it was the real moment of the gift from God which led to my conversion.
Now, I don't want to embarrass you, but if I remember from previous conversations, once you establish this relationship with Medjugorje, and of course Yugoslavia was being torn up by the war that divided the country, weren't you quite active in bringing relief to the area?
Yes, here probably in America and all over the world there were very disturbing pictures of the things that were going on in the former Yugoslavia, and I had a feeling that I wanted to do something to help. But before I could actually put that into fruition, Father Svet came to me, because again he'd known me from my visits to Medjugorje, the Jewish Christian, they used to call me, and he asked me if I could help him buy a car. So I said, "Well, I haven't got the money to treat you to a car." He said, no, I didn't expect that. He says, "But raise money and people will be generous." Because Father Svet had lost his car in an air raid at the time that the convent in Mostar had been destroyed. And there were about 100 nuns there, and about 30 or 40 of them were quite elderly. So because they had lost their convent, he started placing them, two in one home, three in another, one in one home. So he dispersed them all amongst the Catholic community. But they were very uncomfortable at having been separated, and they didn't feel at all happy without their sisters who they'd lived with all their life. And Father Svet had lost his car, so he came to me and he said, "It's so important that I get another one." So I put an advert in the Catholic papers in this country and said that with the Father Svet has asked us to help, and he wants us to buy a car. So, and I told them the reason, and a lot of money came in, far more than was needed to buy the car. So Father Svet came here and he drove his car back, and he continued with his ministry. But in the meantime, we had all this surplus money, and because we saw what was going on over in Croatia and in Bosnia, I decided that I would put that to some use. And so I continue to advertise this time to help the war victims in the Bosnia-Herzegovina, because my heart was really directed towards Medjugorje. And again, people, you didn't have to advertise the needs because the needs were on the television every day. So more and more and more money came in. Now, this wasn't a planned enterprise. It just happened. And having spoken to the Franciscans, what you really need, you need this, that, or the other, they said the main thing we need is vehicles. Vehicles to take food and medicine to remote places where we can't get to the people. We need four-wheel drives because it can be very muddy or very icy, so we need these vehicles. So there was money coming in, but there wasn't enough to buy more than a few vehicles, and their needs were very considerable. So I thought of a scheme whereby I would invite people to join a convoy and drive to Bosnia with vehicles full of food and medical supplies, and then come back in a coach which we would buy, and so they could leave the vehicles there. And then I said to them, as this started to happen, it started to grow, I said, well, you can be very helpful if you would sponsor the purchase of the vehicle. So they used to sponsor the purchase of the vehicle. We used to fill the vehicle with supplies, and then we would drive the vehicle in a convoy all the way to Medjugorje or Split, and then we had this second-hand coach, and we used to drive back, having left the vehicles and the supplies there. Now, I was very badly criticized because people that responded to want to go on these convoys were all sorts of people. They were young students just having a gap year out. They were married men. They were people who were experienced, like firemen, policemen, and so on. But they were also retired businessmen, and some of them were 70 or 75 years old. And we never refused anyone to go on the convoy, so they all drove. And the criticism was that these people who weren't experienced in driving in a convoy, sooner or later a bad accident would happen. And of course that was on my conscience, because it's a long drive and it can be a very dangerous drive, and that it was likely that an accident would happen. But we devised a system that was simple. Simple systems were always the best. We had a fellow called Bernard Boris, who was a Croatian, and he would drive at the back of the convoy. He would be the last one. And then in the front, we had a fellow called Martin Terry, who was an experienced army man and had driven in convoys. So these two were at the front and the back, and they were in radio contact. And the drivers were told that if there were any difficulty, if they were tired, or if they're not feeling well, they should drive onto the hard shoulder off the road. And soon all the other vehicles would follow them, and it would come to Bernard Boris, who would radio to Martin Terry at the front that they've stopped, and he would stop, and the convoy would regroup. And the other thing we told them is they mustn't carry maps, they mustn't look at road signs, they must follow the vehicle in front. And we did 24 convoys. We delivered 180 vehicles, and we never, thank God, through God's grace, we never had an accident. And the visionary Ivan was one of the drivers. So that was a wonderful, it was a wonderful happening, and we managed to deliver over 10 million pounds of aid, and we collected £3 million. So that was a wonderful experience, and I was badly criticized on television as being a Croatian national and not impartial. And I suppose we try to be impartial, but the Muslim community and the Orthodox didn't really want to accept help from us. But whenever we could, we shared it. As for a Croatian nationalist, and the Franciscans were accused of being Croatian nationalists, which they were, because for many years under Turkish rule, they were denied the opportunity of practicing their faith. So they wanted freedom only to practice their faith and to help the people in their communities. And if that's a Croatian national, well, they were Croatian nationals.
Well, there's certainly nothing offensive about bringing humanitarian aid to anybody in a situation like that.
No, Jewish people would always try to help other people in the Jewish community. And they would do that. They also helped other denominations, but their heart would be in helping their brothers and sisters. It's a fact of life. And there are always excuses and reasons for not doing something. And if it's a question of being impartial, you might end up doing nothing. So it's better to do something. And, you know, in a war situation, it's very difficult, because it's the community that are fighting with the community. And, you know, with the Red Cross, they were stationed in Belgrade, which was the capital of former Yugoslavia and now was the capital of Serbia. And the Red Cross, because they wanted to be impartial, they ended up making no deliveries for fear that the deliveries would get into the wrong hands. So there you are. Humanity can be very stupid. It can also be very kind and very wise.
Yeah. Well, we've pretty much come to the end of the hour. I just wanted to give you a chance to share any reflections you have with our audience, or your experience of the Eucharist or confession, or, you know, one of the advantages we have coming in from the church from the outside is that sometimes, I don't know about you, but I know that sometimes, you know, I'm left kind of amazed by the extent to which cradle Catholics can be running on automatic pilot and not recognize what they have in the Catholic Church. So I don't know if you have anything you want to leave us with.
Well, I don't want to preach, because who am I to preach? But I do think that the gift from God, the gift from Jesus, is such an immense one that it shouldn't be taken for granted. And the fact that he comes to us in his body and blood, his true presence, to nourish our bodies and our minds is such an amazing thing that it's a shame that Catholics don't realize the magnitude of what their privilege is. And when it comes to confession, I think people should go to confession about once a month, because what a wonderful thing that God, the creator of the whole world, is willing to be there and forgive you for anything you're truly grateful for, or truly sorry about that you've done the wrong thing. Now, cradle Catholics, unfortunately, they don't have all these gifts in the same depth as converts have, because converts made a decision to change. And in your case and in my case, it was a long journey, it was a difficult change. But they are just going on from day to day with traditions that they follow, and I think it's a shame for them. So I think it's a good thing within the Catholic Church if people really are told and try to explain to them the privilege that they have in receiving communion and in the gift of confession.
And that's a gift that we have as converts to the Catholic Church, right? Because it's through our eyes, it's sometimes a little bit more apparent to Catholics just how unique what they have in the Church truly is. So
yes, you see, we made a choice. They didn't make a choice. They found themselves where they were.
Well, I mean, I don't want to take any credit for it, because like you, I was dragged kicking and screaming into the Catholic Church. You know, I'm often reminded of those words of St. Stephen. You know, you Jews were always a hard-hearted and stiff-necked people, reluctant to believe the prophets. So,
yes.
So as you've said in your case, it's all grace. It's just all grace.
Yes. Well, I'm very happy. It's brought my wife and I closer together. We used to have rows like many married couples do. We used to have differences. And sometimes one or other of us was really hurt. But I can recommend this to all the people that hear this tape. The greatest gift that you can have in marriage is to pray together in your house, if possible with your children, but if not, just together, and set aside at least an hour each day for joint prayer. And when you have joint prayer, God comes into your relationship, and it becomes very special. And now Sue and I never row, because we know God is present within our marriage.
That's beautiful.
So that's a wonderful thing.
That's probably a good place to stop.
So there we are. Listen, Roy, thank you for inviting me on your program. I think you're doing wonderful work, and I think this is spreading the word, and may God bless you and your ministry in every way.
Well, thank you, and thank you for joining us and sharing your story with our audience. I'm sure it's done a lot of good for a tremendous number of people. And I want to thank our listeners, of course, for tuning in. And, of course, invite you to join me again next week on Salvation is from the Jews, same time, same place. And if you would like to listen to the show again, or perhaps download it and put it on a CD and give it to friends or whatever, all of the shows are archived on the Radio Maria website, radiomaria.us, as well as on my website, salvationisfromthejews.com. And you can just download the shows and do whatever you want with them. Spread the word. So thank you, and please join us again next week on Salvation is from the Jews. Bye for now.
You're listening to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. The program you just heard was a rebroadcast of Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Shoman.